This is David Mitchell, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 29th of October 2011. David Mitchell, Part 2.
Why did you, in the end, decide to go back south again? It wasn't that long, was it, before you went back again?
No, we got back from Greenland in November. I thought I'll stay at home for a while and get a job locally. I think I got home something like the 15th of November. Decided I'd stay local. Rang up a local company and said, "Oh, you can start on Monday." I rang him on Monday and said, "Look, I can't start work. I said it's not for me. I'm going to see if I can find something else for you." So I rang up Richard Hansen, who had taken over from Eric Salmon's role at HR. I said, "Have you got any jobs, Richard, for the summer?" He said, "Well, you can go to Halley next week if you want." So I went to Halley on the Halley 5 rebuild. So I ended up, flying down to Halley and spending the summer at Halley, which I enjoyed because it was I'd never been to Halley before. Mm. It's obviously very different to Faraday in terms of it in South Georgia and everything else in terms of the mountains and stuff, but it had its own appeal and I enjoyed it. Spent the season there working with a couple of people that I'd worked with before, but also met a lot of new people.
I was going to say, very different from the scenario at Faraday where you were your own boss. At Halley you were part of a major
completely
rebuild team.
Completely,
you were being told what to do.
Yeah, completely, yeah. But to be honest with you, I knew it was going to be like that. And because it was the summer, it didn't really affect me that too much. I think it would have been different if I'd been wintering, but I was in no intention of wintering at Halley. So it was just a summer trip. And to be honest with you, I was thinking, well, you know, I need to earn some money, and there's worse places to earn money as to working at Halley. So,
were you impressed with what was happening down there?
I was more impressed with the old base, to be honest with you. People living under, you know, obviously the so many people in from the past, FIDs who have lived, you know, at Halley, well, obviously 2, 3, and 4. Under the ice, and that to me was more impressive than the base we were building that was going to be above the ground. A lot of it was obviously impressive with what was going on. For me, who was interested in the polar lifestyle, if you like, it was much more interesting seeing how people were living sort of, you know, 30 feet underground for a year or more. That was more interesting.
How did you cope with it? Because you were staying underground as well, I guess.
No, we weren't. No, yeah. We were in tents, big tents, right. Very comfortable. Al Whedon's known for his cooking skills, and he kept us well fed. Yeah, no, it was great. I enjoyed it. It's not something I would have rushed back to because it didn't have that Antarctic kind of exploration feel. It was more of a job.
An industrial.
It was. But I enjoyed it, and I met, you know, a lot of great people there. And
what were the challenges wiring up Halley 5?
Just the cold, really, to be honest with you. I spent a lot of time actually working underground in the melt tanks, so it was a constant minus 18, but you had a lot of wiring to do, so kind of, you know, cold fingers and stuff like that. But there's nothing really that jumps out that was particularly hard or anything like that. It's just a way of life for a month or two, really, to be honest with you.
Did you go and see the emperors?
Yeah, I didn't get to see the emperors. I did get to see some emperors, but not at the main colony. We were just too busy. We were working 12 hours a day.
So it was 7 days a week. Hard. I guess it was full on, wasn't it?
It was full on, yeah. It was full on. I think we did used to have Sunday afternoons off, I think. I'm trying to remember now. but I tend to go skiing. If I was doing anything like that or do a bit of running or that kind of thing. So I never ventured too far. But no, there was nothing stand out, but enjoyable nevertheless. Yeah.
You got into this kind of yo-yo scenario where you spent summers either south or north, depending upon...
I did.
Which
I
one think for it was summer out, if you like.
Exactly, it was a perpetual summer. Perpetual summer, but...
So you're back north again after Halley?
Well, after Halley, I went on a South American with some friends, travelled up through South America. But Crispin got in touch with me again and said, would I want to go up to Svalbard? So I ended up up in Svalbard, working with Brian and Elizabeth Harland, who fortunately have passed on now, but they were, you know, the pioneers for geological exploration in Svalbard. And I think, I don't know how Brian, Brian was at the time. Brian must have been knocking on 70 at the time when I was up there with him. But his knowledge and some of the things that he used to do, you know, when he was going out there and, you know, in the 50s, and it was just incredible, really. You know, some of the boat trips and the sort of the ski trips and stuff. But we had a great, I really enjoyed the season. Really did. Went to Njolsund, up into Lyftifjorden, and saw my first polar bears, and we did a lot of mountain kind of work. Obviously not with Brian and Elizabeth because they were getting on a bit, but going up and collecting samples for them and that kind of thing. And had a great time. Really enjoyed it, yeah. It was different, obviously, from the Antarctic, because it was so much more amateurish. Without being disrespectful, there wasn't the big operation. It was just four or five of us going up, you know, chartering a boat, staying in Brian's hut up in Njolsund, and you know, doing a bit of a geology and then jumping back on the boat again and going back, completely different to the similar aims as the James Ross geological trip, but on a much smaller family orientated version, if you like. And it's great, yeah, it's great.
I mean, geographically, do you have a preference for one polar region over the other?
I will always remember Faraday and the Antarctic for what it gave to me and the beauty of it. But obviously going on to the Arctic Ocean, to me, is the standout wild place, because it's so hostile. And much as I love the Antarctic, and most of my affinity is with the Antarctic and its beauty and where I effectively, you know, it's shaped what I am. Nothing compares to walking on the Arctic Ocean, really. Nothing at all. No, it's an amazing place.
You were offered in 1990 the opportunity to go back to Faraday as base commander.
That's right.
I think you were given a choice, weren't you?
I was. I could. There was Rothera or Faraday. It was no competition for me, really, you know. I wasn't really interested in Rothera. It was too, without being disrespectful, I thought it was sort of very commercial. There was a lot of, again, mechanical sort of aids, if you like. And I really do kind of tie in with the kind of the small scale, small base, sort yourself out kind of environment.
So what was your preferred style as a base leader? Were you modelling yourself on somebody you'd been under previously, or did you have your own?
Not really. And to be honest with you, to this day, I don't really know what people thought of me or or how they thought it went. I just tried to be as fair as possible. And I guess flexibility is in my nature anyway. I do try and see the different points of view. Everybody's got their point of view. And I guess a lot of time it gives me more work than it doesn't, because obviously I'm stuck in the middle of two or more points of view, but everybody's got their own argument. My take on it was that if people are doing their job to the best of their ability, then, you know, you couldn't really ask for any more. And if as long as people weren't going out of their way to be particularly obnoxious or damage other people's enjoyment of where they were, then, you know, to be honest with you, the base ran itself, you know.
There were no crises?
Not personnel-wise, no. Our first winter, the radio operator resigned the day before winter started, so we ended up doing the radio operator's job ourselves.
He went back with you?
He went home, yeah. He went home. So we ended up being radio operator as well, and that gave me the sense of, well, you know, everybody's expendable, really. You know, if I wasn't here, then, you know, things would still carry on because, you know, it's how you set up the routine, really. And I enjoyed being BC because I like to see people, if they're comfortable in their surroundings, being able to kind of express themselves and obviously do the work that they want to do. And also, obviously, I was more interested in the exploration and the skiing side of things. But if you weren't into that, then, you know, so be it. You know, obviously, you have an affinity with the people who are into similar things to yourself. But that's the only thing, really. I mean, I hope that people thought I was a reasonable person, really. And certainly, I don't think there was no major issues that I can recall, anyway. And I'm sure I would if there was any.
So you were south. On that particular trip, you were down there for three years.
Only for the summers. The permanent base commander's role is one of the Antarctic summer in the Antarctic and the UK summer in the UK. So it would vary between sort of, 4 or 5 months down in the Antarctic and then come home, prepare things for the following season. And go back down, and because obviously the summer period is a more intensive work period, to be honest with you. So you're preparing all the jobs that need doing back in the UK and getting all the stuff ordered and going down and just making sure that work was carried out in the summer. I loved it. In many ways, it was a perfect job.
Well, it's getting your permanent summer policy.
Exactly. And, you know, when I was down there, I was very much of the opinion that, you know, if you've done your job, then go out and enjoy yourself. And, you know, we'd still go out on the mainland, we'd go skiing, you know. I had the excuse that, oh yeah, I need to take you to the mainland to show you how to do this and where this is and where that is. So I'd spend, like, loads of time out climbing and skiing. So
had you been running a relationship at this time, or was this still...
No, still, still free and fancy, just...
So no complications?
No complications. Life was just so easy.
But it was about to get tough because Steve Martin made you an offer you couldn't refuse, and I'd be interested to know how that came about. This is the idea of trying to cross the Arctic ice cap.
Well, the full story of that is, is that Steve and I always intended to go back to Greenland. And we'd done east-west, and we were going to do north-south. Obviously a much bigger undertaking. Mm-hmm. And that was always in the back of our minds. So, back in the summer, I think it was 92, can't remember. Steve said to me, we were talking about Green, he said, do you not fancy the North Pole? And what you have to remember is, at the time, apart from people like Wally Herbert and Robert Peary, nobody had ever been to the North Pole without any kind of resupply. Okay, Wally Herbert had a resupply as well, but, I mean, he's a legend himself, and he obviously spent a long time on the Arctic Ocean. But nobody had ever been to the North Pole without an airdrop of some description to supply them with food and fuel and everything else. So Steve said, do you fancy going to the North Pole? I said, well, if we're going to do it at the North Pole, we need to do it properly. We need to do it without any kind of form of resupply or airdrops. And not only are we going to need to go to the North Pole, we've got to get back again as well. So for me, this really was going back to the really early days. Okay, it can never be that, because we all know the situation now, that if you know, things really did go completely wrong, then, you know, there's a chance that you could get picked up by an aircraft. But really, the challenge was, for me, was we need to get to the North Pole and we need to get back again. And I think Steve said yes, but I don't think for a minute he ever thought that it was ever possible. I mean, people were telling me up to 5 years ago that that was never possible and that would never be done. But it's been done now, you know. And so, but to me, it was always possible to do it. It was always possible to do it. And I said, well, rather than going there and back, we picked up this, I did a lot of research then into the Arctic Ocean and the currents in the Arctic Ocean. And there's a thing called the Transpolar Drift Stream, which effectively flows from east to west. I said, well, why don't we, rather than going there and back, why don't we start in Russia, go to the pole, end up in Canada, and follow this conveyor belt of ice that will make it so easy for us that you will wonder why nobody else has done it in the past. Obviously, Nansen had tried it in the Fram in the early part of the century. He'd got frozen into the ice up at the DeLong Islands. And it was him that really discovered the Transpolar Drift Stream, but he got spat out somewhere to the east of Greenland. So we'd set off. So anyway, we ended up going back down south, working a season as a BC again, and I met up with some guys off. I met the guy on a yacht, because we used to get a lot of yachts in, and with a lot of very interesting people on. And I'm embarrassed to say, I can't remember the chap's name at the moment, but he was the first guy to walk to the North Pole solo.
Obviously, with all finds?
No. With a lot of depots, French chap.
Okay.
And obviously had a lot of depots and and all the rest of it. And I said to him what I was thinking of, what we were thinking of trying to do. And he looked at me and he said, he'd also been to the South Pole as well. I always remember what he said. He said, the South Pole, he said, it was just boring, boring, boring. But he said, the North Pole, that was a real adventure. And I thought, yeah, you know, this is what I want to do, really. So I handed my notice in at Bass, worked the last season at Bass. And spent that was in 93, and then made an attempt in 94, starting off very close to where Nansen left the Fram, trying to use his Transpolar Drift Stream, which was, to be honest with you, getting to that point was amazing, because Russia had only really finished Perestroika, and just getting to there, I mean, Westerns had never been there before. It was an incredible trip just getting to that point in Siberia, to be honest with you. We had a chap with us who was the official photographer, who wasn't the official photographer, he was the KGB man who would keep an eye on us whilst we were
what mischief traveling. Could you possibly get
exactly,
up to?
Exactly. But you see, I had $50,000 taped to my midriff because everything had to be paid for in cash.
Mm.
And when you go to places like that, you realise that life means nothing to them. And so we had to pay cash at various stages of the trip to ensure we'd get to the next point. And if any of these pilots had known that how much money I'd had taped to me, I mean, I wouldn't have made it back. It would have been nothing to them. You know, $50,000 would have been a decade's worth of pay, at least. So it had all those kind of edges to them, which made it a really fantastic trip. Steve and I were supposed to be going with a guy called Keith Burgess, who went across Greenland with us, the three of us. But he dropped out. And at the time, I was adamant that three was the right number to go with. So we ended up going with a guy called Clive Johnson, who'd also wintered at South Georgia. And whose name had come up in conversation. And he joined us as a three-man team.
So Clive was with you for the first attempt?
For the first attempt, yeah, but he got very badly frostbitten. We ended up having a lot of problems with our sleeping bags due to a manufacturing problem. And he got very badly frostbitten fingers and feet. And that takes me back a bit, actually, to a trip we had from Faraday in my second winter. Three of us manholed on the mainland, and temps were down in the minus 40s, and we were obviously manhauling, and we were out for a week or so. And one of the chaps there got frostbitten on an attempt on Mount Shackleton, and we ended up having to haul him back. We took, got him back to the tent and rewarmed his feet. And he was a big guy, and I've never seen a man scream so much. But, you know, he got his feet back again. But we ended up then having to manhaul him back to the coast, close to a place called Rasmussen Hut, which is a place that I love. Of all the places, Antarctica, that's a great place. So I'd already had this experience of frostbite, and I knew then that really there was no way he was going to be able to continue. If he wanted to save his fingers and his toes, there was no way that we were going to be able to carry on, because we couldn't leave him. And we were set up for a three-man team. We had these problems with the sleeping bags, and to be honest, it was so cold, and that is the coldest I've ever been. You wouldn't go to sleep at night because you were scared in case you weren't going to wake up, because the sleeping bags had deteriorated so much that we just used to lie awake. We'd set up with the Russians that we had an emergency distress system in place, and once the appropriate funds had been wired into their bank account, then they came out and got us. And we'd been on the ice for about 3 weeks. But that was the first time I'd been on the Arctic Ocean, and I learned so much in that fortnight, or that 3 weeks, that I vowed that we would never make the same mistakes again. And to be honest with you, it was on the way back through Russia that Steve and I, we made a pact that we'd go back. Because however horrendous the trip had been, and it had been pretty horrific in terms of the cold and obviously what had happened to Clive, that we felt that we had to go back, really. We set up a lot of things to save the children and all that sort of stuff. We felt like we had a lot of people down. We really felt like we had let people down. We spent the next 3 years trying to raise money then for the next attempt, really. I didn't work for that period. We were just constantly looking for sponsors who were prepared to fund the trip, really.
That must have been quite a challenge, I would have thought, particularly as you'd already not made it once.
Exactly, it was. And Steve and I, we're nobodies, really. You know, nobody knows who we are. You know, if you're Ranulph Fiennes, you've got a huge name behind you. Yeah. Of course you have, and it's understandable. But the Royal Geographical Society supported us. They felt that it was something worth pursuing. By then, somebody had reached the North Pole without resupply, so that was out. But obviously this crossing was still, it was still the impossible journey, really. So we thought we'd give it another go.
The Aberdeen radio controller in the TV documentary, Channel 4's TV documentary, Flo Howell,
yeah,
said there was a 1% success chance.
If that, yeah.
So you knew that?
We knew that. You know, because you can prepare for a lot of things, but you won't beat Mother Nature. That's for sure. And it relies so much on the ice conditions. Obviously bears and the equipment you've got and food. And it's just so tight. I remember before we went to Greenland, we were really worried because we were going to be really late getting it, into sort of October, November, and there's no GPS system or anything like that. We taught ourselves how to use a sextant. I remember ringing up Wally Herbert and saying, who is my, one of my idols, sort of saying, and I called him Mr. Herbert, and I said, we've got this, I'm really worried about going across Greenland because the sun's going to be so low in the sky that we won't be able to get a sextant sight because it needs to be a certain altitude. And his words were, don't worry about it, just go. So I thought, well, if it's good enough for him, then it's good enough for us. So that's the principle we applied, really, to the second North Pole trip. But we were absolutely scrupulous in everything that we did. We didn't take anything. If somebody was offering us something for free, but it wasn't what we wanted to take, then we didn't take it. We just took everything was as we wanted it. And The biggest thing was the diet. People kept telling us that the diet wouldn't work because we looked at all the expeditions that had gone in the past and everybody came back emaciated, telling tales of, you know, starvation and disaster. So we thought, well, we've got to try something different. We don't want to be in that position whereby, because the trip's going to be so long, you know, 100 days, we've got to carry 100 days food and we've got to have sufficient supplies. So we looked at the diet completely differently. And instead of going with what everybody recommended, all the experts, if you like, were saying, you know, increase the carbohydrate, reduce the fat. We just went with massive amounts of fat. You couldn't get much more fat in the diet. And protein to rebuild muscle loss. And very little carbohydrate, which is obviously completely opposite to what you'd have anywhere else. And I think I put a couple of kilos on.
Well, there's this film of you with pots of lard.
That's
freezing
what we had.
Lard.
Yeah, that's exactly literally what we had. We had suet.
Yeah.
We just ate pots of suet.
Mm.
And
but what struck me about that video was the almost hopelessness of the situation when you were on the road. You were doing less than 3 miles a day at times across the ice, and there was that balance between getting worn out and resting.
Yeah.
And not resting too long in case you got too cold.
Yeah.
So you were almost like being driven by the devil, weren't you?
Yeah, we always walked 10 hours a day, every day. And we'd stop for 3 stops of 10 minutes each. Because if you stopped any longer, it was just too cold. Plus, you had to keep walking because of the unfortunate circumstances we had with the wind direction. All the ice has been, we set off from Russia, and all the ice has been blown back to Russia. So we might walk 3 miles during the day, but overnight we'd lose 4 miles overnight. So we'd actually be starting off in the morning a mile further back than where we were the previous day.
This is negative drift, isn't it?
Negative drift, yeah. And it was just completely demoralising. Completely demoralising. And the sledges were, you know, they were heavy. They were 200 kilos each.
It was 2.5 times your own weight.
Oh, yeah. Did. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not a heavy person. I'm 70 kilos, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, but it's like we said, all we can do is get up in the morning and walk. That's all we can ever do. And as long as we can do that, then we'll just keep on going until the food runs out. And obviously, you know, our fortunes changed. Unfortunately, not soon enough so that we had a chance to get to Canada, because the ice was just breaking up very badly around the pole and it wasn't possible to continue. But, you know, we got to the pole and, you know, to me, it's not a failure because we did the best we could. But, I it wasn't what I wanted. You know, we all wanted to walk from Russia to Canada. But we got back and people say, no, it's impossible. That'll never be done anyway. It'll never be done. But, you know, 5 years later, it was done. You know.
Were you expecting to meet polar bears?
We hope not to. but we were prepared for it.
Sawn off shotgun.
Yeah, we had a shotgun. I mean, getting that and soft-nosed ammunition through Russia is a story in itself. If you've ever tried to smuggle arms into Russia, it's not straightforward. and don't get caught. But we managed it anyway.
You were not caught?
No, we weren't caught. We managed to sort of secrete the ammunition on our bodies.
Really?
Yeah. And get through, yeah. Once we were through customs, we were okay. Because the guys on the other side who were helping us, they knew that what we'd have to do, you know. So,
what were the Russians nervous about then? Revolution?
Well, I guess it's a similar. If you try to take a sawn-off shotgun and a few soft-nosed bullets through Heathrow, I don't think they'd be too chuffed, would they?
In fact, did he not take them through Heathrow? Because if you took them into Russia...
We did take them through Heathrow, yeah.
Yeah. Take them out of the country.
We,
With a licence or not?
The rifle was licensed. The shotgun in its full length was licensed. It was licensed for transportation only. And I remember getting off the tube station at the stop before Heathrow, arranging to meet a man there who would provide me with a double barrel shotgun. I would then put it in my bags and then go to Heathrow, because it wasn't licensed for the UK. It was only licensed. So the whole thing was a bit kind of dubious, to say the least. But it worked. Got it there. But yeah, so, but as it turns out, obviously, I mean, we did, very early on, we encountered a polar bear, and the outcome was very sad, because obviously we ended up having to shoot it, which is not something any of us ever wanted to do.
Just the one incident?
Lots of tracks, but the only incidents, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you'd see tracks quite regularly of bears.
Were there other unofficial measures that were taken like that? Unofficial events? Anything else you had to smuggle? Or lie about?
Well, that was the big one, really, to be honest with you. Okay. It's always the money thing, because obviously you can't take money, large quantities of money, so I ended up the same thing again with a lot of money kind of secreted on this, really. But no, that was...
How did you actually know when you got to the pole? Because if the ice is moving around all the time, the landscape's constantly changing.
Well, obviously by this time, the advent of the GPS is a wonderful thing. So we knew roughly where we were. I'll never say I've stood at the North Pole, because I probably drifted past it about, you know, 50 yards away or something like that. But for Steve and I, it was close enough.
And were you fated? I mean, although you hadn't succeeded in getting across the whole of the Antarctic from one landmass to another, what was it that you were regarded to have achieved?
For Steve and I, it was really just, it wasn't the achievement per se from anybody else's viewpoint. It was more for ourselves, really. We were never really sure about what the feedback would be. There was a number of people who felt that there was issues with our kind of trip and it shouldn't be recognised. But at the end of the day, you know, we felt we'd give it our best shot. We couldn't have done any better. And it seems to be recognised as, you know, the first sort of British successful attempt on the pole.
So it was the first British unsupported polar arrival.
Yes. Yeah. Seems to be accepted as that. But I guess everybody will have different viewpoints, won't they, really? At the end of the day.
Achieved by an electrician and...
Yeah, and a boatman. Steve was the boatman at South Georgia. Yeah, he was the boatman at South Georgia. Yeah. It was great.
What did Sellafield make of all this? Did he ever hear about how your Sellafield...
I do see people, obviously, that I worked with previously and everything else, and I guess they've got... I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't really talk about it that much. I guess people have their own viewpoints, but... You know, to me, that was the collection of knowledge and experience that started that first day when I got off at Faraday, really. And all the times that I fell through the sea ice at Faraday led to that trip. And it was never really the same going back to the Antarctic after that, really. Because it just felt so special, getting, you know, walking on the Arctic Ocean. The Antarctic after that was a great place to go and visit, but it never really had that wild appeal after that trip.
Well, things had changed, hadn't they? By the time you went back again, from the mid-80s to the mid-2000s, the infrastructure in the Antarctic, want of a better phrase, had changed enormously.
Of course it had, yeah.
So what were the standout changes for you?
The food was a lot better.
And clothing?
And the clothing was obviously, you moving away from kind of natural materials, the man-made materials, it's the same with every generation. Every generation, there's always an improvement on the previous generation. That's the way of the world, and that's how it works, and that's how we get better at what we do. And I never felt uncomfortable with the clothing I had in 1985, but I suddenly realised how much more comfortable I was with the clothing that I had in 2000. And that's just the way it is, isn't it?
And instead of the phone calls being £9 a minute, they were free.
Well, you know, time moves on, doesn't it? I mean, I would imagine that the people who went down for Bass in the 30s, the 40s and the 50s would never change the period they were in because the people in the 70s and the 80s had it too easy. You know, you never change what you experienced. I never had the opportunity to go in 1940 and 1950. So you take the opportunity you've got at the time in the 80s and the 90s, and it was fantastic. And the people that go now, I hope, will feel the same, despite the fact that they can go on the internet and watch a film or, you know, ring their loved ones at home.
Well, you've been with some tourists, haven't you? There was one tourist ship that you joined at one point.
Yes, there was.
Signature South Georgia in 2001 or 2.
Yep.
How was that, for seeing all these grockles, these sightseers?
I enjoyed it. Yeah, they were quite interested in base life and you know, I tried to sort of impart some information to them to make it more interesting for them. But that is the first and only time I've ever been seasick. Was on that ship. Amazing. You think of all the time you spent on all the Bass vessels, but that was the first and only time I've been seasick.
You've got a polar medal.
Yep.
Not too surprising, but this is the first time in 100 interviews if I have to ask you which pole you got it for.
It says both. It's for both.
Oh, it's for both.
It's for both. So it says it's for Arctic and Antarctic, and I'm mildly proud of the fact that, you know, that obviously it's a fairly special medal because it does cover both regions, and there's not many being cast.
Exactly.
So
it says on the back for both, does it?
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
For Arctic and Antarctic. Yeah.
And are you now offshore quite a lot because you're either working out or running a wind farm?
That's right, yeah. I work on the Robin Rigg wind farm off the Solway coast. So it's a bit different.
On a platform?
No, we only go out, we don't spend any time over there overnight. It's only days we go out there for. So we're only 15 kilometres offshore, so we kind of in and out on a day basis, really. But it's a different life. You know, it's interesting.
Are you in charge of it, or are you just...
I'm kind of part of the management team, yeah, so I look after the engineers.
Is it the future?
I think it is, yeah. I think where we are now with renewables is, if you think that where we were a number of years ago with maybe some other aspects of power generation, in that it's too early to judge it. Because we're such at an early stage with the sort of size of the machines that are available, in 10 years' time, the machines will be of a sufficient size that it can actually provide much more power than what we deem possible today. And let's face it, we have to do something, don't we?
We do.
Yeah.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
No, thanks. That's been great. Thanks, Chris.